This is City Lights on 90.1 WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, and I am delighted to introduce my next guest this morning. He's headlining the Punchline Comedy Club this weekend. Nimmer, welcome to City Lights.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, it has been so much fun to read up on you. I mean, you are literally the rock star comic of the Middle East.
Well, thank you for saying that. I'll take it.
Well, let's talk about the surface details of who you are and where you're from, because obviously that informs your comedy.
Yeah, it does. It affects it completely, 100%. What would you like to know? Where do you want me to begin?
You were actually born in Lebanon.
Yes, ma'am.
And then your family came here,
mm-hmm.
but they moved back to Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the formative years. It seems you spent in the U.S. Mm-hmm. as a child, and I understand you wanted to be a Ninja Turtle.
Mm-hmm. Straight up. I mean, is there a more humble profession?
Which one? Raphael, Donatello, which one?
Everybody used to tell me I should be Michelangelo because he was the Joker, but I always saw myself more as Raphael. That was more, because he still had a sense of humor, but you know.
Cowabunga
was the Michelangelo. I appreciate Michelangelo. His fine taste of pizza was much appreciated,
yes.
Of course, but Raffy was my boy.
I love it.
When I was two, we left Lebanon, not of our own choice. There was war. We didn't leave as refugees. We left as immigrants. I think if we had stayed a bit longer, we would maybe have left as refugees. And we came to San Diego, which a lot of Lebanese like to go to because it's very similar in climate and warmth of people to Lebanon.
I know that everything I've heard about Lebanon is how exquisitely beautiful the country is.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It's a very breathtakingly beautiful place. It's smaller than San Diego County, the whole country. But that gives it a very unique ability. Like, you can go to the beach and go skiing in the same day. It's gorgeous. But the real treasure about it, besides the views and all that, which are breathtaking, the villages, it's the people, the warmth of the people. And it's very unique because of all the civil war that happened for, you know, over 30 plus years. And everything we've been through since the civil war has created, from the furnace of all of that, a people that have a love and an appreciation for life and for one another that is very, I have yet to see in other places. And I think a lot could be learned from it. And I think you can only learn that lesson once you go through something so trying. But the people and it's a beautiful, the spirit of it is really what's the magic is there.
So wouldn't it be wonderful if more of that spirit was spread around than the political and religious conflict?
Well, that's what I'm here for. When I left the Middle East to come back here and do stand-up, it was after I had achieved everything there was to achieve as a stand-up comic, as an artist that I had set out to achieve in the Middle East. And then when I came out here, I came out here about 3 years ago, so it was before all of this division came to the forefront. But I came with the same mission to kind of bring people together here. And I think it's timely that my brand of comedy right now is working really well with what's going on here. Because it would be much nicer to spread what we have in common as opposed to what we don't.
I loved reading about your father's response when he took notice of your being on the cover of the feature story of a very famous publication.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let you tell the name and the story because it's so hilarious.
The Rolling Stone magazine. Before my father, when I first told my dad I wanted to be a stand-up comic, he thought, of course, I was, as any Asian person listening or, would understand, disappointment in your parents' eyes can be heavy, especially with ethnic cultures. You know, following your dreams is never encouraged whatsoever, unless your dream is to be a doctor or engineer. So, and I studied finance and I had helped establish the family business and it was doing very well and there was a lot of money and it was security, everything was there. And I wanted to leave that to do stand-up comedy in English in the Middle East without using politics or religion, which was what everybody did when it was comedy.
And that certainly was a secure lifestyle that you chose.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
And a noble profession.
I ate more tuna in the first 3 or 4 years out of cans than I think anybody has in a lifetime. Like, you know, it definitely wasn't for the money. And when I told my dad what I wanted to do, he was like, oh, so your dream is to become a clown. That's that's phenomenal. And he was hilarious. My dad bought a horn, and every time I'd come to the house, he would use the horn, like, to announce me. So he just, you know, like a really old school.
Like Harpo.
A Harpo, exactly. Old school clown horn. But when I did make it to the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, that was when he was like, this is my son, you know, the comedian. And I always told him, follow your dreams. You know, he stepped in and took the credit. But it was, I say it in my comedy, I say it like my dad was saying it, like he was taking credit. In reality, he was saying it very sarcastically.
Oh.
Like I always told him to follow his dream. In a way, kind of like, I'm so proud of him that he achieved all of this despite me telling him it was a mistake. Because my dad taught me a very valuable lesson, which I do hope to teach to do for my kids. You shouldn't support your kids' dreams. You shouldn't. You can support them financially, but you shouldn't support
and you have to if they go into stand-up.
100%, but you shouldn't support them emotionally. Because if they can't overcome your lack of support, they're not going to be able to overcome the real world. And that's, I think, what my dad was doing, was like, my job as your guardian is to constantly remind you about everything that can go wrong. If I do that, then if it does go wrong, then I've done my job. I told you. I'm not going to sit here and say, don't worry, kid, it'll be fine. How are you going to pay your debt? How are you going to pay for this? How are you going to date? You can't afford to eat yourself. Just constantly reminding me of the difference. If somebody's constantly reminding you and you're fully aware of what you're getting yourself into and you still win, then it really was meant to be.
I was hoping you would talk some more about performing your stand-up in English. Do you think that limits your audience in the Middle East, or is it a draw?
Fortunately, for me, English is a very popular language pretty much all over the world. In the Middle East, it's very popular. In and of itself, the language is very popular. In the Middle East, it's doubly popular because there was so much war and a lot of people were displaced, and they went to English-speaking countries, be it Australia, Europe, London, England, or the U.S., or many of the other English-speaking nations. So a lot of the people who live there now don't really speak Arabic that well. They speak English better. So for me, it helped as being a draw, because here you have all these Arabic comedians, and the market is oversaturated with all these comedians, not stand-up comics, but, you know, sketch comics and stuff, doing all their comedy in Arabic, and then this one guy comes along in English, and now you have this whole swash of people who are like, finally somebody for us, and they happen to be the majority. So that's why it, you know, for lack of a better use of words, it blew up across the Middle East as it did.
Were it only that this would that stand up and its infectious appeal would be the only thing blowing up in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Well, you are credited basically with establishing stand-up in the Middle East, not only in Lebanon
but across
in the region. And we've been fortunate to have had Veer Das,
of course,
who's credited with establishing stand-up in India. Mm-hmm. And in February, Gad Elmaleh was here. And, you know, pretty
he's a great
much
comic, Gad.
Introducing it to France. Mm-hmm. But with you and each of those comics, you're not the household name here in the U.S.
No, of course not.
That you are in your own country.
Of course not, no.
So how humbling is it to play smaller clubs and to people who aren't familiar with you?
It's very humbling, but at the end of the day, the profession we're in is a profession of humility. Comedy is the one profession, I think, where it doesn't matter who you are. Somebody once gave me this example in Los Angeles. They said, you could be Jack Nicholson. You'll come on this stage and you will get so much love from everyone because you're Jack Nicholson, but it'll last 5 minutes. If you don't say something funny, you're going to lose the audience. And that's what's amazing about stand-up. You have to be good. And unlike music, you have to reinvent yourself and be good every single time because you can't repeat the same hits, right? So if I'm a comic and I get very famous off of a few hit bits that go viral, people are going to come to see my other stuff expecting the same quality.
Yeah.
So it's a very humbling profession. For me, coming here, one of the main motivations was like, it's going to be great. I'm not known there. This is a new challenge. I have to be good enough. Because I did feel like I was getting a bit comfortable in the Middle East because people are buying tickets. They know what you're about. They've taken, I now don't have to do the first like 20, 30 minutes of work are done. People know what I'm about. They know who I am. They love my brand of comedy. I could even tell jokes where the punchline didn't have to be even completed because people know what that term that I've made up or that thing that I've done. So that's when you, that's the danger. If you're a craftsman, that's the danger where your tools start to get blunted. So you're like, I got to go back into the field. And I figured coming here to the US would be an amazing challenge to get Americans to become a household name here is the objective. And the way I want to do it is objective, is the more priority objective, which is by bringing people together. I don't want my shows to be selling out with Arab Americans in them. I want them to be selling out with Arab Americans, American Americans, European Americans, Asian Americans. I want it to be a unity thing. And if I can unite people here and I can unite people in the Middle East and then I can unite them together, because I do have a goal, and that's the goal that I'm working for, is to do a huge show in a few years that we film and broadcast live online for free, and then hopefully people all over the world tune in to watch it at the same time. And then you can always use that as an example when somebody says this world there'll never be peace, and you can say, but there was that one night where everybody all over the world was laughing at the same joke at the same time, and that's when you're united.
So you avoid politics and religion for the most part
I think because it's easy. Just like I had to actively work to avoid cussing, which I've now achieved. It's going for politics, going for making jokes right now based on Donald Trump, super easy. The comedy writes itself. And this isn't me dissing Donald Trump. I'm just saying from a purely comedic perspective, I mean, Barack Obama was a disaster for joke telling.
John Stewart said that when he was
elected. It was horrible. There was nothing. And even if you had the best impression of Barack Obama, there wasn't much you could do with it. Donald Trump, you don't even need an impression. So he's very generous in that way. It's the easy way out. Religion is the easy way out. I can sit, when somebody writes something and you critique it, that's easy. But if you want to dive into the philosophy of it, I won't make jokes about Donald Trump, but I will make jokes about things that Donald Trump did and the reactions that people had to it, because then I can expose the underlying factors that gave rise to that. I may make fun of the fact that Americans didn't see Donald Trump's win coming, and then I'll dive into what made that happen and find the humor there. That in the Middle East has been kind of like a ninja tactic. By avoiding the naming of religions or politics, I've been able to deal with the much more dangerous results or underlying foundation of religion and politics, and kind of get my message across much stronger that way.
So this is circling back to what we talked about when you came in mm-hmm. studio before we went on air.
Hummus?
Okay, we were talking about hummus, and I didn't even get to the baba ganoush.
Okay.
Comics today, stand-up comedians today, are our philosophers mm-hmm. because of your observational comedy.
Yeah, and I agree.
So this is underlying your desire for a global streaming comedy.
Well, take a look at all the hate in the world today, right? It's an ideological battle that we have today. Wars are no longer about, you know, back in World War I, World War II, you take over a region, it's now under your control. We're now dealing with something much more dangerous, which is the mind. And when you're dealing with something like that, when the enemy that's out there isn't a person, it isn't a nation, it isn't, the enemy is a thought, an extremism, if you want to call it extremism or whatever. When you're dealing with that, your role is much more, you have a lot more responsibility riding on your shoulders if you're addressing topics like that. When I'm doing jokes and talking about ISIS or people dying and making it very funny, but getting the message across, you got to know what you're talking about and where you're heading with it to stay, you know, needed in society. We have a role to fill. I mean, we look for the light as comics, and you can't find the light if you don't walk through the darkness.
But ultimately, comedy, I believe, is more profound.
It is.
But it's so much more difficult given the situation in your native country.
Mm-hmm. Or our neighbors right now, Syria, or Libya, or Yemen, or Saudi Arabia, or America right now. If you take a look at the division, what's very dangerous about what's happening in the U.S. right now, the U.S. enjoys a sense of security, which I hope it always has, because geographically, sending an army here is just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But people shouldn't feel safe enough to start openly hating as if there are no consequences. The seeds that are being planted right now are very dangerous. And we've lived the consequences of them. They have damage that lasts generations. It causes economic damage, damage to brain capacity. There's a lot of stuff that can have negative effects. And then, of course, there's always, you know, fights that become too violent and people expressing them. My philosophy is a bit different than others. I think that the way to heal the world is through the embracing of hate as opposed to spreading love. And a lot of people always look at me like, what are you talking about? And I say, well, love is easy, right? But hate is dangerous. It's dangerous. What a lot of people do is they dismiss hate. And that's the wrong thing. A lot of people dismiss hate. Oh, he's a racist. She's a racist. So they just dismiss him. You can't dismiss hatred. You need to acknowledge it. That's a big problem. If somebody is saying something that's very negative, you need to A, understand why they're saying it, B, understand it like ingrained in you, and then C, push back. Push back at it means you need to engage with this person on their level. So you need to understand where they're coming from. Everybody who hates has a reason to hate. For them, it makes sense. Just because it doesn't make sense to you doesn't mean it's going to not develop into something very dangerous. So you need to understand hate. You need to understand that hate exists. You need to embrace it and use it.
And you're telling me then ultimately you use it as the foundation for humor.
I do, because I hated the fact that I lost friends due to wars that we had nothing to do with. I hated the fact that refugees have become pawns in a political game, that right now their lives are being destroyed and nobody cares because they've been mismarketed. I hate the fact that people don't realize that in generations from now, this is going to come back and be very dangerous for them, because these people are also having adverse effects of this, these refugees. I could go on and on. Because I hate that, and I want it to change, I use that hate to fuel everything I do. It's a very positive way of using it. You know what I mean? And I think if people looked at hate as a more positive thing than a negative thing, because when you look at something negative, the second it appears, you just want to push it away. No, as soon as I see hate, I'll sit down with it and talk to it. Just like when I went to Oklahoma and 2 weeks before I went to do a show there, a man shot a Lebanese guy and killed him and had run over his mom a few weeks earlier, like this horrible story. Instead of seeing that and then dismissing that hatred as, oh, you know, there's racist people or whatever, I dove into the community where that guy was, invited them out to the show and had them sit down with a bunch of people. I did some community outreach. I talked to people. And I think we made some big, big changes over there, because I recognize that hate is misguided passion. I'm just going to realign that. And that's the best way to go forward and do it with a joke.
Wow.
Because you put somebody who hates Arabs or hates black people or hates whatever with the people they hate and get them both to laugh at the same joke, you've just made more progress in that 1 second than anybody has in maybe 50 years, just because they laugh together.
When you're performing in other Middle Eastern countries, there must be something of a divide between the people who come to enjoy your work and those who think it's sacrilege.
What I do is I take it one step at a time. The first shows that I did in Saudi Arabia, or the first shows that I did, the approach that I have to it, whoever comes out, if it's 6 people or 6,000, I'm going to give them the greatest show ever and leave them with thoughts that when they go back and the skeptics face them, like, oh, why'd you go to that show? This guy's whatever this is. They actually say, no, it was great. And then the next time I come around, they bring them down. And because I started avoiding swear words as well, I started getting entire families together, from the grandchildren to the grandparents, the whole like 10, 15 people coming in a group. And I was consistent. I never had a short-term objective. I said, I can do this in 10, 15 years. That's exactly what ended up happening. Over the next, from 2000 to 2014, I was very consistently good in my marketing and my approach and in the material I was putting out there. And everything that I would do would always have a positive result, that the reputation, the branding became known as, this is a guy that you see that even if you disagree with, you respect. And that was what led to the huge numbers and the unity and making ISIS's life very, very difficult in Lebanon when they tried to come into the country and they couldn't find a way to root in a division or two. Because a lot of the work I had done, a lot of things that I had pointed out, people see them now. because there was a joke about him. When ISIS would try to put in some propaganda, people would laugh. And that, you have no idea how destructive it can be if somebody's trying to use a political sentence to divide someone, but a comic has a very famous joke referencing that type of sentence. And it, instead of getting hatred, instead of getting fear, you're literally getting people going, you remember that thing? Now if you're ISIS, you're like, oh God, this is terrible. How are we going to win?
Are you ever frightened for your self,
no,
your
I never,
security?
No, I'm Lebanese. we're impervious. All that hummus is like built in bulletproof.
I know that garlic is a curative, so
there you
know,
go.
Maybe this is
no. Helping. I'm not afraid because ISIS doesn't come from us. ISIS isn't in my society.
ISIS, I don't understand.
No, but I mean it's important because if I was in Saudi Arabia, where you will find more sympathetic people towards ISIS, then that would be a much more dangerous thing for me. But I come from a great, strong people that have afforded me the luxury because they've championed me to be protected. And they take care of me. So we give back and forth. I give my life to them. They give their life to me. And then I give my life to the world. I'm also American. And I love this country just as much as I love Lebanon. And what I do here, I take just as seriously as over there. And I've done shows in Oklahoma and Nashville and places where Arab American comics might not go. I've had wonderful reception by everybody. I'm giving a talk next week at Harvard University. And we've reached out to a lot of the anti-Arab military groups, stuff like that, to come to the show. And they're coming. And they'll come, and there are people who hate Muslims and people who hate Arabs, and they're coming. And I assure you, by the time I'm done, they either won't hate them as much, or they'll not hate them at all. And that's the thing.
Nimr, I think that healing the world through comedy is a very noble idea, and it seems that you're putting it into practice. It's gone way beyond an idea. I thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Nimr will be at the Punchline Comedy Club in Buckhead with two more shows tonight and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We'll post this interview along with more information at wabe.org. Bravo.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's go eat some baba ganoush.